Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. This is the first show of 2016. It features two great guests who are both contributors to the new book, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. Paul Craig Roberts, the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, is the first guest. And James Petras, a very renowned sociology professor, will do the second half of the show. If you like this kind of radio and would like to keep it going throughout 2016, please go to truthjihad.com. For only $3.95 a month, you can keep these shows on the air and get early access to all the shows. And plus, I don't blog much at my open blog anymore, but I do post occasional entries at the private blog for members only at truthjihad.com. So please go to truthjihad.com and keep this show alive. I want to bite the hand that feeds me. I want to bite that hand so badly. I want to make them wish they never said this. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you all of the best guests telling it like it is. People who don't beat around the proverbial bush or even the proverbial Cheney. People calling out the neocons for their horrendous crimes in destroying the constitutional order in the United States of America and killing over 1 million people around the world in wars launched on lies. Today I have with me one of the truly great truth tellers of our time, a man who has held some of the highest establishment positions in the land and nonetheless is not afraid to tell it like it is. As you may have guessed already, I'm talking about Paul Craig Roberts, the man largely responsible for Reaganomics when he was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, man who has been editor at the Wall Street Journal, who's worked at the Hoover Institution, generally has about as powerful a resume as anybody around, and still, he is telling it exactly like it is in language that does not mince a single word. So it's just a tremendous pleasure and honor to have with us today, Paul Craig Roberts. Say, how are you, Craig?
Just fine, Kevin. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you, you know, and I really respect your journey from kind of saying, you know, there are some serious problems with 9/11 to today as we are facing one apparent false flag after another to keep this so-called war on terror emergency going. You're not just asking questions. The minute it happens, you're saying, you know, this really stinks, and following up on it. What has led you on this journey from, you know, somebody who was right in the middle of the establishment to one of our most hard-hitting truth tellers?
Well, Kevin, I didn't get to be in the middle of the establishment because I told lies. It was a different time. There were some serious problems, and there were some serious people still at that time in government and wanted to be able to address the problems. So it was possible for somebody who was willing to do something different, to see things in different ways, to get into high positions. We were, you know, stymied by stagflation. We were tired of the threat of nuclear war from the ongoing Cold War, and to work the way out of these two problems, it took a different perspective, and there were enough people to realize that those of us who had a different view found a voice inside the government and inside establishment media like Wall Street Journal. That's different now, but that's the way it was then. So as I see it, I've always called it as I've seen it.
Well, today calling it as you see it is pretty hard because they've built a kind of a wall of fear around truth speaking, especially around these really kind of crucial bedrock foundation issues like what really happened on 9/11. And you're not afraid to talk about that, to call out the apparent false flags in Paris. We had two huge apparent false flags this year, and you're appearing in both of the books I'm editing on these events. We Are Not Charlie Hebdo is the first one, came out in March. And then the new one that's just about to appear, which is called Another French False Flag. To what extent do you think that these false flags, and especially 9/11, have been responsible for changing the climate in the ways that you've talked about?
Well, Kevin, I've always said that the main change was the collapse of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was a constraint on American unilateralism. The United States could not act unilaterally anywhere on Earth. It could do so in some places, but in other ways it was checked by the Soviet Union. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, this is what really released the neoconservatives. They then said, look, there's no longer a constraint. We are it. We are the sole superpower. We are the unipower. There's no limits to our ability to shape the world as we see fit. So this is what unleashed all of their projects, the Project for New American Century, their series of countries in the Middle East that were going to overthrow. They needed a new Pearl Harbor, and they got that with 9/11. So I've always thought it was the Soviet collapse which removed the constraint on American unilateralism that launched the differences. And of course, once they were launched, they needed a new Pearl Harbor. They got that with 9/11. It's obvious that the story of 9/11, the official story, can't be true. And once they got all this going, it never quite worked out like they thought. And it raised lots of doubts among allies, and so they would need to repeatedly use false flag events to keep allies on board, like France. In the United States, I think the security complex, so they could gain ever more power. And so I think they have employed them, as in the Boston Marathon bombing, which I think must have been a false flag operation. So you have false flags serving really two purposes. One is to keep the neocons control over American vassal states, and the other is to build the power of the domestic security apparatus. So either of those can throw up a false flag.
I agree with that analysis. There's one aspect, though, that is a bit puzzling, which is why have they created this phony enemy of alleged Islamic extremism and jihadism, when in fact that is not a threat? The real threats are the geopolitical threat of the Eurasian landmass uniting against North American hegemony. And the biggest single threat there, of course, would be China, not so much Russia. Today, Russia is all in the headlines, but The Atlantic magazine has an interesting piece out now about the rise of China, pointing out that in geopolitical terms, we're looking at a very likely World War III U.S. versus China scenario, unless something very unusual historically happens. So why have they demonized Muslims, gone to war against the people that should be the allies of the U.S., against Russia, China, and kind of this Eurasian world island?
Well, Russia and China are not threatening the United States or the West. The threat comes from the U.S. to them, because the Wolfowitz Doctrine proclaims the principal goal of American foreign policy is to prevent the rise of any other power that could serve as a check on American unilateralism. Well, of course, Russia under Putin has proven to be a check, and the remarkable advancement of China has made them a check. But the aggression comes from the United States. You know, we have proclaimed that the South China Sea is an area of American national interest. We have allocated 60% of the American fleet to that location. We are challenging China in every way that we can figure out, some of which are included our military, our Navy, violating their 12-mile limits, We have attacked Russia in a number of ways, principally by overthrowing the elected government in Ukraine and establishing an American vassal state, unleashing violence against the Russian populations of Ukraine. And these are very serious and reckless and irresponsible actions on the part of Washington. The consequence of this action by Washington has been to create a Russian-Chinese strategic alliance. So there won't be any possibility of the United States going to war with just one or the other. If the United States goes to war with either, it will be at war with both. Both countries now realize that the United States intends to destabilize them in whatever way it can, with economic sanctions, with propaganda, with encouraging dissent at home, as we did with the riots, the student riots in Hong Kong, as we do by encouraging terrorism among the Muslim populations. You know, both countries have Muslim populations. So I think that the problem with Russia and China is one that Washington created. As for the Muslim terrorists, well, we created Al-Qaeda as part of the force that we used against Russia and Afghanistan, or against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And when the neoconservatives launched their agenda of overthrowing seven countries in 5 years, you know, Iraq, Syria, Libya, is supposed to include Iran, I think Saudi Arabia even. When they began that, they had to have a bogeyman, and all of a sudden that was bin Laden. Bin Laden was responsible for 9/11, according to the story. And so we had this alleged war against Al-Qaeda, which was the cover for the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq. And of course, Iraq had nothing whatsoever to do with bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. But this was the cover we created for the wars. The wars didn't turn out as we thought. They were very badly rehearsed in the various minds in Washington. Nobody had any real idea of the consequences, the unintended consequences. And the so-called 3 week or 6 week cakewalk war turned out to be 8 years. Indeed, it's still going on. As for Libya, this was the creation, in my view, of ISIS. It was an American creation used to overthrow Gaddafi. And then when that was achieved and the Russians and the British Parliament blocked Obama's planned invasion of Syria, Washington sent ISIS to overthrow Assad. So these are, in effect, were our tools. And if you think back, it was only a few weeks ago that the United States was adamant against attacking ISIS and was really horrified and disturbed when Russia stepped in and began those attacks. I think that the U.S. has been sort of forced into abandoning that position because it was convenient to blame the latest false flag attack, the Paris bombings, or shootings, Paris shootings, on ISIS. So it's become difficult for the U.S. to maintain the position that it had. But for the United States to try to exercise hegemony over Russia and China, this is hubris beyond the imagination, arrogance, hubris that's really so extreme it's hard to imagine it.
Well, I agree with all of that. There's an alternative view of the geopolitical situation that's expressed in the book that I'm editing, in which you're participating, another French false flag. It's offered by people like Imran Hossein, one of the Islamic world's great geopolitical analysts, as well as the greatest living Islamic eschatologist, and Ken O'Keefe, among others. And I share this view to some extent, which is that when I was at the University of Wisconsin in 2001, 2003, I saw very clearly that this invasion of Iraq was going to result in precisely what has happened. It was going to destroy the country. There was going to be sectarianism. There would be massive resistance against U.S. occupation. It was going to create chaos. That was utterly obvious to me, even though Iraq wasn't my focus. Morocco was, but I knew enough to see what was coming. And so did all the other people who were paying attention. And so I really question whether any of this was unintended consequences. I would argue for an alternative analysis, as have some of these other people I've cited, which is that the reason for 9/11 and those seven countries in 5 years was because those seven countries are the countries that posed a threat to Israel, not to the U.S., and that U.S. Geopolitics rationally would have stayed the way it was during the Soviet era. And we would be calling the Islamists all over in Russia and China, the forces of liberation, not terrorists. We should never have even created this ridiculous notion of Islamic terrorism in the first place if we were being rational geopolitical actors on the basis of working for the American national interest, even an evil American national interest such as world hegemony. But indeed, what happened was on 9/11, neoconservatives who are loyal to Israel, not to the United States, overthrew the government of the United States, seized power on behalf of the extremist faction of the Likud Party of Israel, and have been misusing American policy in behalf of the Greater Israel Project. Sheikh Imran Hossein says that what we have today is a unilateral Israeli empire, not an American empire. I know you don't agree with that, but maybe you could explain why that's wrong.
Well, it's not entirely wrong. Because the neoconservatives, or at least the leading elements of them, are themselves Jewish, tightly allied with Israel. But I think what's wrong with that view is it doesn't really realize the extent that neoconservatism is an ideology, and one that sort of merges or is at least partially compatible with the old liberal internationalism, the notion that the U.S. is somehow the proper leader because of its virtues. So I think the reason that the neocons launched their agenda in the Middle East was they saw it as easier, certainly. At the time, it wasn't clear that Putin would bring Russia back and that Russia would make would assert an independent foreign policy. China's development was underestimated. I remember it wasn't that long ago, people were saying it would be 50 years before China. And so that caught the strategic thinkers in Washington off guard. I think that they did begin their agenda in the Middle East, not because any of those countries were a direct threat to Israel. I don't think these countries were threatening Israel. They were in the way of Israeli expansion into southern Lebanon, into completely gobbling up all of the remnants of the West Bank. And so to sort of remove obstacles to Israeli expansion, that was convenient, and it worked with their ideology, but the ideology existed independently and was asserted very early. It was asserted by both Krautheimer and by Wolfowitz. I think the Wolfowitz doctrine was set to paper in 1992. This is the proclamation of American world hegemony. I do think it was used for the benefit of Israel. But that was the easiest place to start this. But I don't think that they expected the war in Afghanistan to go on now for what has it been going on for, 14 years? Or the one in Iraq, we were there 8 years before we pulled out, and now the whole country is coming apart. They were expecting to establish Washington puppet states like they have in Europe. I think they were expecting to continue to use the forces that became ISIS or ISIL. I think those forces just realized they were independent and it took on a life of its own, and Washington lost control. But so in that sense, I don't think this policy was based on, oh, let's save Israel. I think it's been used in part for advancing Israel's position, but it is a policy more akin to that of the French Jacobins, you know, the French revolutionaries, that were going to take liberty, equality, fraternity to all of Europe. And the neocons are just going beyond that. They're going to take the American way to all of the world. And we shouldn't overlook that this is a larger and wider and more dangerous aspect of neoconservatism than simply advancing the interest of Israel.
I definitely see that viewpoint, although I would argue that there could be a kind of a different form of congruence of these two interests, in that we have, on the one hand, a series of Israeli documents showing that Israel's policy, or at least policy of a certain group of people in Israel since about 1980 with the Oded Yanon plan, has been to plan to balkanize the Middle Eastern countries around Israel on ethnic and sectarian lines by basically just destroying them and smashing them to pieces. And that's precisely what was being called for, although in slightly disguised language, in the 1996 Clean Break document that the neocons wrote that was commissioned for Netanyahu. And then in 2000, they rewrote the Clean Break document, which was very clear that this was all about saving Israel by smashing up all of the neighboring countries. And then they changed this and dressed it up as though it were in the U.S. interest, and gave us Rebuilding America's Defenses. I would argue that that was all nonsense, that they were simply conning the stupid and hubristic American leadership into pursuing a path that had absolutely predictable consequences. I don't believe that anyone who had the slightest knowledge of the Middle East believed that there would ever be a peaceful, happy, democratic American protectorate in Iraq. I think everyone knew precisely that we were going to get exactly what we got, and that was only in the Israeli interest, following all of these documents from the Oded Yanon plan on. So in to that extent, I would say that I don't think that the Middle Eastern consequences have been any different from what any competent person ever expected. But I see your point that the same kind of hubris, perhaps, that drives Israeli expansionism has been applied to American imperial expansion as well. And now it's run up against Russia and China, and you've been warning that we might be facing a third world war. If you were going to give a kind of an odds, a Jimmy the Greek's odds of an all-out kind of nuclear World War III in the next 5 years, what would you call, and what would be the basis for that prognostication?
Well, I've said that, as I see it, as long as you have this neocon doctrine of American hegemony, the only way you can avoid war is for Russia and China to agree to be vassal states. And
good luck with that.
And give up an independent foreign policy. And I don't think that that's likely. And so I think the momentum is war. And I've said the only thing that can really break it is for some major European country to realize that this is not in their interest, and that NATO is the enabler of this, and pull out NATO. And then that would begin to stampede out. And then without NATO, this notion of confronting Russia or holding on to an empire, that would be gone. And so the neocon ideology would simply be eroded by results. So I think that that's it. Either the neocons give up their ideology, or Russia and China give up their sovereignty, or some major European country gives up its NATO membership. Other than that, it looks to me like the war is much more likely than during the most difficult periods of the Cold War. Let me say one quickly, just one point about this Israeli motive. It doesn't strike me that it's in Israel's interest to have an Islamic State of jihadists there, because to replace secular leaders that suppressed the Islamist jihadists, like Saddam Hussein did, like Assad in Syria, and like even Gaddafi, to replace people who have control with jihadists, I mean, that is what I would be fearful of if I was Israel, because if the Islamic State prevails in Syria and Iraq, Israel will face definite threats of a military sort. I mean, we've already seen that Israel could not defeat Hezbollah in Israel's last two forays into Lebanon. Now, if they're faced with Hezbollah and the Islamic State, they will have created massive uncertainty for Israel. So I don't agree with that interpretation of the motive, because Israel was far better off with those secular Arab leaders who were suppressing all of this jihadism. Well, I think...
Yeah, we've hit the end of the half hour.
We've hit the end of the half hour. Don't see any real major disagreement. We see all of these forces working, and there's nothing really to be gained by saying one eliminates the other or one is more prominent than the other. That's the nature of things. You know, there are so many different forces that have a stake in the game. You know, the oil companies have a stake. The military security complex has a stake. There are enough people, enough interest groups with a stake in this to keep it going. And that is how it becomes the reality.
That's an excellent point. I don't subscribe to the one eye in the pyramid controls everything kind of conspiracy theory. I believe that everybody's out there conspiring for their own interests. Well, thank you so much, Paul Craig Roberts. I appreciate your amazing and courageous work. Thank you for your contribution to the new book, Another French False Flag, and I look forward to talking again down the line.
I look forward to it as well, Kevin.
Okay, take care. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, a radio show going all out for truth, 4 or 5 guests a week. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you the best people I can find, telling you the hard truths that they don't want you to know about over in the corporate-controlled mainstream. Today we're going back to a crucial topic, which is the misrule of the banksters. The term banksters is unfortunately all too apropos. The people in charge of our monetary system are criminals because the whole system is criminal fraud. This is something that many of us have known for a long time, but the details are quite interesting. They actually seem to be hiring people over at IMF who pretty much fit the bill. We've got a rogues gallery of crooks, rapists, and swindlers in charge of the IMF, according to sociologist James Petras. James Petras is one of the world's leading sociologists and international affairs analysts. In his latest article, IMF's Rogues Gallery, Crooks, Rapists, and Swindlers, is a very engrossing read. So take it away, James Petras. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Yeah, it's a great article.
Well, should we start with my thesis?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Well, I looked at the last 5 executive directors of the International Monetary Fund, and it's a very revealing analysis if we look at it in depth. For example, the current executive director of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, is on trial in France for misappropriating $400 million payoff to tycoon Bernard Tapie while she was finance minister in the government of President Sarkozy. There's no justification for this payoff, and the prosecution is charging that this was some kind of an electoral payoff to bring the tycoon aboard in supporting her prime minister. It looks very serious, but the main thing is that this is the person that's in charge of directing financial policies for the IMF.
And she hasn't had to step down.
No, not yet, and probably not unless she's sent to jail, which is a unlikely prospect because very seldom do you get high-level bankers going to jail. At most, they get a slap on the wrist.
Well, it wouldn't look good to have the IMF run out of a prison cell.
Well, that would be a bit of a dubious distinction, I think. Let me continue on. It wasn't just that Lagarde is an exception. Her predecessor, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, was forced to resign after he was charged with raping a chambermaid in a New York hotel. And while he was facing those charges and later civil charges, he was also arrested for pimping in the city of Lille, accused of engaging in procuring prostitutes for businessmen in a luxury hotel. And this finally cooked his goose as far as having a career in the IMF.
Well, you know, there's been a counterview on this, which is like coming from folks like Paul Craig Roberts, who suggests that he was actually getting a little out of line with the powers that be, and they may have set him up. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't think he was out of line. He was very much involved in the imposition of policies on Greece. He was very much involved in imposing the austerity policies on Ireland. I don't think he may have tried to soften some of the rough edges, but he was very much in the mold of IMF officials. I think it's splitting hairs in this. On this particular issue, I disagree with Craig. I think he's magnifying marginal differences, and I think by and large the IMF directorate stayed with him until it was he was impossible to continue backing, especially a repeated offender like that. He was thought of as discrediting the organization's main function, which was to be a predator organization, and they didn't want his personal idiosyncrasies to interfere with his role as the enforcer for the financial vultures in Europe and the United States.
Well, in fact, actually, pimps and rapists are probably pretty much the right kind of people to work for such a predatory organization, but I guess they're not supposed to get caught.
That's exactly the point. And I'll get to that when we try to analyze why these kinds of people with this kind of behavior get selected. Now, preceding Khan was Rodrigo Rato, and he was a Spanish banker who was arrested and charged with tax evasion, concealing 27 million euros in 70 overseas banks, and swindling thousands of small Spanish investors who he convinced to put their savings in a Spanish bank called Bankia that he practically guaranteed, and that went bankrupt shortly after his urgings led to thousands of small people getting into that operation. So here you have a corrupt official handing out government money in Lagarde. Then you have someone who's involved in assaulting women and pimping. And now you have a swindler. Now the next person is a German, Horst Köhler. and he resigned after he stated an unlikely verity, namely that overseas military intervention was necessary to defend German economic interests, such as free trade routes. Now, it's one thing for the IMF to act as a tool for imperial interests. That goes without saying. But it's another for an IMF executive to speak about it publicly. That's a no-no. And the fact that he was so indiscreet and exposed the IMF to in effect justify the critics who say the IMF is part of an imperialist policy, which is to dominate countries and use military force to ensure their access to the economies, the financial systems, the natural resources, etc. That's not appropriate behavior. It's one thing to be a predator. It's another thing to say it publicly.
That's right. Well, the official line, of course, is that the various wars being fought are all against evil bad guys, terrorists, radical Islamic terrorists in the Muslim world, terrible evil dictators like Putin, whatever, whoever is the enemy du jour. It's always because they're very bad people that we go to war with them, and certainly not to protect these looting schemes. So I guess when he came out and said that, he was kind of implicitly supporting the analysis of people like you and John Perkins, the IMF whistleblower, and other folks who've pointed out this is a giant racket.
Exactly. And the fact that Kohler spoke out is a sign of either his embedded in a milieu where they talk about this all the time, but he was addressing the wrong audience when he went public. It's one thing to talk to private bankers about the need for gunboat diplomacy. It's another thing to say so to the mass of the general public, which ostensibly is supposed to be convinced that its intervention is for noble purposes, which everyone is supposed to believe. Now, the last one I looked at, going back from 1987 and later, is Michael Camdesis, a Frenchman, who was the author of the Washington Consensus, the doctrine which underwrote the global neoliberal counter-revolution, essentially enshrining the idea that privatization, free trade, and knocking down any financial regulation is necessary for prosperity. Now, his time of office, he embraced the worst dictators of the time, including taking photo ops with Indonesian's strongman Suharto, responsible for 500,000 murders in 1966. And Camdesis was very proud that he embraced this fellow and others besides him, including Pinochet and others, because they adopted policies in line with the IMF. Now, the worst thing about Camdesis is that he collaborated with Argentine President Menem in liberalizing the economy and deregulating financial markets and privatizing over 1,000 enterprises, the jewels of the Argentine economy. This kind of wild capitalism led to a crisis which produced the worst depression in Argentine history, with over 20,000 bankruptcies, 25% unemployment, and poverty rates exceeding 50% in working class districts. Camdesis later said he was sorry that he made a policy mistake with regard to the Argentine collapse. He was never arrested or charged with crimes against humanity. Now, all of these characters that I mentioned to you, people that destroyed economies, people that embraced gunboat diplomacy, swindlers, and the rapist and criminal behavior, and the misappropriation of funds. These kinds of behavior are not anomalies. They are the kinds of people that the bankers can understand, because it's the kind of predatory activity that they engage in on a grand scale. And moreover, the fact that the IMF is involved in imposing the death sentence to so many low-income people around the world by imposing austerity plans. You need these kinds of perverts, high-level perverts, to carry out this hatchet job. I mean, after all, the IMF intervenes in countries' policies. They violate the sovereignty. They dictate economic policy. They dictate social policy. Lagarde dictated that to Greece, pensioners who are now on the poverty line have further cuts. In other words, that they go below the poverty line, and she doesn't want any changes. But at the same time, these same people that have this kind of predatory behavior, they're the same persons that give away huge loans to puppet governments. Now, everybody knows, including especially the Ukrainians themselves, that the current government of Poroshenko and company was imposed by the U.S., by our friend Nuland. And we know that they have done a massive job of lowering subsidies, increasing prices, and stealing on a vast scale. Now, this has been published in the Financial Times that the biggest rip-offs are taking place now, with the oligarchs taking a very large percent of any capital flows. The IMF knows that. They have people on the spot. But still, the IMF has forwarded close to $15 billion, with another $15 billion in the pipeline, despite knowing that this is a very corrupt oligarchical government that's done everything that violates their own charter, and yet the IMF, following the lead of the NATO powers, is trying to prop up this government. So it's not economic criteria, as the IMF claims. It's political alliances, political fronts, attempts to weaken Russia, to surround Russia, that is motivating the IMF to keep the flow going into the Ukraine, into the oligarchs and kleptocrats' pockets.
And it seems kind of hypocritical, doesn't it, that the IMF is telling Ukraine that it's perfectly fine to stiff their creditors over in Russia. That really unveils the complete hypocrisy and charade of this being supposedly a neutral financial bonding kind of agency that's talking about creditworthiness in the abstract. It's obviously not the issue here.
Well, clearly not. As I mentioned, it's political criteria. And if you look at the way the executive directors of the World Bank and the IMF, the World Bank is the prerogative of the U.S. So any official that's appointed head of the IMF automatically goes to the United States. I did a study years ago of IMF directorate and how they formulate policies, and I actually interviewed the second, third in command in the IMF, and they admitted to me that before they make any decision, they meet with the Treasury Department officials and get their marching orders on who gets what kind of money, under what conditions, and how much. So the IMF, World Bank, is very tied to U.S. policymakers, while the IMF is always a European. As I mentioned, a French, a German, usually in charge, and they consult with both the European and U.S., and they are responsible for intervening in these countries on behalf of the multinationals, and that's very politically convenient, because all the hostility is then directed at the IMF. It does all the dirty work of breaking down any kind of regulation and then the multinationals who work with the IMF move in. And in a way, the IMF sets the tone of what policy will be and deflects criticism from the multinational corporations.
So if they put Europeans in charge of the IMF and Americans in charge of the World Bank, how is it that the IMF doesn't become more of a sort of an engine of the European point of view and European interests? Pepe Escobar, for example, has famously argued that as soon as Europe, meaning Germany, the economic engine of Europe, decides to unite with Eurasia, meaning Russia and China, and throw the Atlanticists out, that we're going to see a massive shift in global geopolitics. And he says that would be in their interest. The European interest is not to prop up these American puppets in Ukraine and to pursue these other kinds of policies. So why is it that the IMF seems to be so enslaved to American policies if it's dominated by Europeans?
I don't think it is. I don't think that's true. I think the IMF acts on behalf of the multinationals and the banks in Europe, as well as the United States. And I think in the Ukraine, the Germans and the French have been playing a very important role in trying to incorporate Ukraine in the European Union and take advantage of their deregulation or functioning under the rules of the European Union so they can pillage the resources and redirect products from the Ukraine to Europe and also to capture the Ukrainian market. So I think this is an exaggeration to see the IMF simply as a tool of the U.S. I think it's a tool of the major capitalist banks in Europe and the United States, and it largely in the recent period with Lagarde has been playing a very active role in squeezing Southern Europe for the Germans and penetrating the Ukraine for the Union and NATO.
So it seems that we're dominated by an international class of kleptocrats. They're probably a lot more loyal to their kleptocratic interests than to anybody's particular country. And you know, if you analyze the roots of this, you know, why do we have all these gangster banksters, these rapists, swindlers, and ne'er-do-wells ruling the global economy? You know, you almost have to get to a psychological analysis like Robert Hare, the expert in psychopathy, did in his book Snakes in Suits, when psychopaths go to work, pointing out that there are a lot of high-level psychopaths in the corporate world, and they seem to have an advantage in certain respects because they're just so innately ruthless. I wrote about this in an article called Twilight of the Psychopaths that went viral. Do you think that maybe we need this kind of sort of criminological and psychological analysis to figure out how to stop these people?
Well, I don't think the psychology, they're not going to put them on a bed and on a couch and recycle them. They have political, ideological, and economic interests. I mean, Lagarde and others have done rotating chairs. They go in, out of the banking system into the IMF, and then they come out and join them. I mean, it's a revolving door. Now, the particular kind of brutal policies that the IMF pursues does require a certain kind of mentality. A person that can hatchet for five straight austerity programs, Greece, and knock down living standards 40 or 50% and generate 30 or 35% unemployment and reduce living standards. You need a certain kind of brutal mindset. You need a kind of person that's immune to any kind of empathy or sympathy or solidarity with the with humanity. You need someone who's very inhumane, someone who has a fixation on money-making for an elite that can overlook people scrounging in garbage containers, old people that are living in heatless apartments. You have to have that kind of mindset. And I think in that aspect, within the politics of the IMF and the economic policies, you do need a certain kind of brutalized psyche.
We've heard from folks like one of my recent radio guests, Robert David Steele, a former CIA clandestine services officer and whistleblower, who participated in our False Flag Islamophobia conference in Paris a couple of weeks ago. He thinks that we're on the verge of a revolution. He thinks that the rise of these sort of populist-type parties in Europe, the nationalist kinds of right-wing populist parties, as well as here in the U.S. with Trump and so on, all of this is a symptom of people gradually, but maybe faster and faster, waking up to the way they're being looted and pillaged, and eventually, and maybe not in such a distant future, reaching the point where they don't have a whole lot more to lose and rising up. And in fact, he thinks it could become chaotic and destructive. We could have civil wars, and he's hoping to head that off with some kind of reform movement. I know, how close do you think we are to serious, major international social unrest?
Well, I think the unrest is appearing on the surface. You have those indignos, you have a great many of the mobilizations against the climate warming. You have had general strikes in southern Europe. But the fact is they lack a political party expression. Now, the right-wing populists have a double discourse. On the one hand, they condemn the free market in the case of the National Front in France. They condemn the European Union as an oligarchical club. They make some very poignant and pertinent criticisms, but they also retain ties with the capitalist class, in particular in southern France, where Le Pen's, I guess, niece was running. She had close ties with the banksters in the south, so it's not clear that these are really radical parties in the sense of wanting structural changes. I think they have focused a great deal on looking downward rather than looking upward. They attack immigrants. They attack people that have social grievances that are not part of their national discourse, instead of focusing on the banks and the multinational corporations per se. So I don't think this is such a transformative group, even though a lot of their criticism, especially in electoral campaigns, has a certain attractiveness. And I think this kind of pseudo-anti-capitalism, this kind of populism, as we've seen, some of them have joined governments and coalitions, and they get thrown a bone on restricting immigration, and they sit in the cabinet. So I think it's exaggerated to say they form part of a new revolutionary wave. I don't see revolution as on the agenda, even as the crisis in Europe and the United States is unfolding. The precariousness of the U.S. economy, the stagnation in Europe, the inability to foment any kind of meaningful employment. This is going to create discontent, but I think it would be a mistake to see all of this channeled into right-wing populism. I think Trump is a phony. I think his billionaire and his boisterous behavior appeals to a lot of people who reject the status quo, but he's another version of the status quo. And I think that's the tragedy of the absence of any progressive alternative to the fake left in the Democratic Party and the right-wing populism. It's just it's a situation that I'm rather pessimistic about.
Well, here in the U.S., the left used to be inordinately Jewish in the sense that people from Jewish backgrounds were heavily represented in it in the Vietnam Civil Rights era. Today, it does seem that the neoconservatives are kind of the avant-garde of Jewish intellectuals who've gone in the exact opposite direction, from sort of left-wing social justice positions towards a kind of a very nihilistic, very authoritarian racist, brutal kind of, you know, loot everybody and that kind of attitude. I just saw a Press TV interview with Paul McKinley from Chicago. He said that Rahm Emanuel's Zionist government in Chicago is doing to the black people in Chicago pretty much what the Zionists are doing to the Palestinians. They're tearing down their neighborhoods, bulldozing them, doing, you know, rebuilding middle-class neighborhoods in Chicago in the same way that they're rebuilding Jewish neighborhoods after demolishing Palestinian homes in Palestine. So what role do you think that Zionism has played in this kind of destructive turn that we're talking about?
Well, first of all, we shouldn't equate Zionism with Jews. I know many, many Jews who have nothing to do with Zionism. They're either inactive or quiet, quietly critical. Now, if we separate out the Zionists from the Jewish population, including many progressive Jews that have been attacking the Zionists, independent Jewish voices and others who have been in support of the boycott, divestment, etc. So I think it's very important to draw that distinction. Now, when we're talking about the principal Zionist organizations, including the presidents of the 52 major Jewish organizations, as they call themselves, they have fused the interests of Israel with the U.S. Empire builders and militarists, and they share a common policies of attacking Arab countries in the Middle East and weakening the nationalist forces in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. And I think they have played a major role in promoting these military incursions, not only as lobbies, as Mersheimer and Walt talked about it, but being actually in the government and formulating policies. And I agree with you, Rahm Emanuel's government in Chicago, his mayoralty has been devastating on the poor and black communities, and closing schools, and keeping a police force that operates as the Israelis operate. And there's probably more ties than simply Rahm Emanuel. There's probably interchanges of tactics and strategies and training. So I think this is a serious problem. I think it's important to point this out, because a lot of writers that publish on these issues don't bring in the Zionist dimension of it, and I think that's a serious mistake.
Okay, I agree too. And finally, but we have only a minute or two left, you're contributing to the new book that I'm editing called Another French False Flag? Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. As a student of possible false flag operations going back to 9/11 and beyond, I think that one of the functions of these kinds of things is to create an atmosphere in which people are intimidated from questioning things. Sort of red lines are drawn. You can't go beyond a certain point. You have to shut down your thinking. You know, 9/11 did this in such a huge way by being right out in the open with the demolition of Building 7. And yet anybody who even looks at this obvious reality about the most important historical event of the century is demonized as a so-called conspiracy theorist. And by shutting down free thought in this manner around all of these false flags, I think that the ruling elite, or some segment of the ruling elite, is essentially preventing us from thinking clearly about a whole range of issues, and they're also preventing us from boldly and courageously asserting our own interests. Would you agree that we have a major structural problem right now around this series of likely false flag operations?
I think the government has been very successful in promoting fear among the general public with the anti-terrorist propaganda, with xenophobia and Islamophobia and Arabophobia. I think they've generated a tremendous amount of fear and frustration and helplessness among the people. And this has been exacerbated by the tremendous surveillance system that we are under. And it's used to justify the growth of a police state, and that's very serious. We have fear of terror, and we have fear of the state, and we have no recourse within the political system except for isolated voices that have raised issues. But the double jeopardy that American citizens face today is a propaganda avalanche that emphasizes terrorism as an immediate problem and everywhere, and the police state that intervenes, including police violence against citizens and arbitrary behavior on the part of the government. I think we have surpassed the McCarthy period as far as creating a climate of fear and uncertainty.
Well, I would agree completely with that. Well, thank you, Dr. James Petras, one of the world's most renowned sociologists and international affairs analysts. I always appreciate your insights, especially this rap sheet on the worst of the banksters heading the IMF. It's a fantastic article. I'll link it at the radio blog. That's accessible by way of truthjihad.com. Click on the radio blog and you'll get there. So thank you once again, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.